Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, among the multitude of harms that could rain on this country should Donald Trump become president again, he could order the Justice Department to drop any charges against him, stemming from his fomenting of an insurrection aimed at overturning by violence the results of the 2020 election. Not to put too fine a point on it, Trump could declare himself above the law. And that's just been enabled by the Supreme Court, which put off until April the legal case wherein Trump declares himself immune to criminal prosecution. The court can move quickly. They hopped right to the decision that Trump can't be removed from presidential ballots in the states. But this, we're to understand, will take, maybe until after the election, to mull. Vox court watcher Ian Millhiser says he tries to reserve his "this is an exceptionally alarming decision" voice, but this occasion calls for it. We'll hear from him this week on the show. Also, corporate news media have an anti-elder narrative as stupid as it is cruel. Keep up or you're in the way, the line goes. If you aren't working 40 to 60 hours a week, you're a societal drain. It's a weird position, erasing and marginalizing elderly people, given that the elderly are a sizable portion of the population and a community we all get to join, if we're lucky. Alfredo Lopez is a longtime organizer and activist and a founder of the new group Radical Elders. We'll talk with him about the space the group seeks to fill. We'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The Supreme Court ruled this week that states can't keep Donald Trump off of presidential ballots, despite his myriad crimes and active legal entanglements. But as New York Times columnist Thomas Edsel noted, the more politically consequential decision came on February 28th, when the court set a hearing on Trump's claim of presidential immunity for his role in fomenting the violent January 6th, 2021 effort to overturn the election for the week of April 22nd. Edsel suggests the delay is a gift to Trump and a blow to Biden because a failure to hold a trial means Democrats won't be able to, quote, expand voters' awareness of the dangers posed by a second Trump term, close quote. A trial, you see, would produce a lot of reporting about Trump's role in the insurrection that could inform and presumably sway voters. I think it's fair to ask ourselves why journalists couldn't do that reporting anyway. Whether the surprisingly large segment of the electorate that Edsel says has either no idea or slight knowledge of the charges against Trump couldn't just possibly learn about those things from the press corps, even without the shiny object of a trial to focus on. Ian Millhiser reports on the Supreme Court and the Constitution, even when former presidents are not in the dock, as a senior correspondent at Vox. He's author of, most recently, The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America, and also, relevantly, 2015's Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. He joins us now by phone from Virginia. Welcome back to Counterspin, Ian Millhiser.
Good to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, your February 28th report is headlined, "The Supreme Court Just Handed Trump an Astonishing Victory."
Yep.
So please spell it out for us why it's a victory and why it's astonishing to a longtime court watcher such as yourself.
I had assumed that the courts were going to try to stay neutral on Donald Trump and neutral on the election. And so what neutrality means is we knew from the oral argument in the ballot disqualification case that the courts weren't going to remove Donald Trump from the ballot. We already knew that was going to happen. But I thought the flip side of it was that the Supreme Court wasn't going to actively try to boost Trump's candidacy by delaying his trial, by pushing it until after the election. But that's what they did. By scheduling this hearing in April, the trial can't happen until after the Supreme Court resolves this immunity appeal. And so they made the decision to, the practical implication of this is that the trial almost certainly will not happen until after the election, if it happens at all. When the Supreme Court hands down such a consequential decision, it's supposed to explain itself. Like the way the Supreme Court works is that when it does something, the majority of the justices who agree with one outcome write an opinion explaining why they did what they did. And then the justices who dissent write a dissenting opinion explaining why they disagree. And the court didn't even have the decency here to explain why. I mean, maybe there's some possible justification for pushing Trump's trial until after the election. But at the very least, they owed us an explanation for why they handed down this extraordinarily consequential decision. And the fact that they thought that they could do this without explaining themselves, I think, raises very serious questions about whether the Supreme Court will be neutral on the question of whether Donald Trump or Joe Biden should win the 2024 election.
Well, I think people understand that the law does not equal justice in the way that we might understand it. But it sounds like you're saying this is messed up on the level of law itself.
When you look at the long arc of U.S. history, the law doesn't always resemble the law. In 1870, we ratified the 15th Amendment. That's the amendment which says the government is not allowed to discriminate on the basis of race when deciding who is allowed to vote. And that amendment was in effect for maybe 5 years during Reconstruction. And then it just evaporated. For 90 years, the Supreme Court did not enforce that. We had 90 years of Jim Crow, 90 years of Black people being told they did not have their equal citizenship rights, even though it's right there in the Constitution saying explicitly that they're supposed to have it. Because, you know, politically, there wasn't enough support for giving Black people the right to vote, and the Supreme Court just went with those political wins. You know, if you look at the history of the First Amendment during wartime, I mean, people were thrown in jail during World War II because they opposed the draft, because they gave a speech opposing the draft. For most of the late 19th and early 20th century, there was very aggressive enforcement of something called the Comstock Act, which, I mean, it's still on the books. This could come back at any time, which bans pretty much any kind of art or literature or anything that in any way involves sex. You know, people were tried and convicted for selling the famous portrait, Venus, The Birth of Venus. It's a nude portrait.
Right.
People were convicted of crimes because they sold reproductions of famous works of nude art, despite the fact that we have the First Amendment. So the reason I'm describing this long history here is I think we Americans need to have a realistic sense of what we can expect from the courts. You know, the courts don't always ignore the law. They don't always follow the political winds. I can point you to plenty of examples of the Supreme Court being courageous against powerful political. I mean, the reason why Nixon had to resign is because the Supreme Court ordered him to turn over incriminating evidence. So the Supreme Court sometimes follows the law. It sometimes does the right thing. But if you look at the long arc of American history, all I can say about the Supreme Court is sometimes.
Yeah.
And apparently sometimes is not now. Sometimes is not now. This court is not going to do anything to protect us from Donald Trump. It has made that perfectly clear. It doesn't matter what the Constitution says. It doesn't matter that there's an entire provision of the 14th Amendment saying that if you are in high office and you engage in an insurrection, you can't hold office again. Doesn't matter. Supreme Court's not going to enforce that provision. And that doesn't mean that we should all abandon hope, but it does mean we cannot rely on the courts at all. Donald Trump will be defeated at the ballot box if he is defeated anywhere.
Well, I'm going to bring you back to hope in just a second, but I just felt a need to intercede. You know, my ninth grade government teacher was convinced, and not without cause, that we really weren't going to retain very much from his class. And he had one thing, which was that every now and again he would just randomly holler out, "What's the law of the land?" And we would yell back, "The Constitution." That seems kind of more painful than quaint right now.
Yeah, I mean, we like to tell ourselves a good story about the United States.
Yeah.
One of the purposes of public schools is to inculcate in us a certain sense of what our values should be. Like, the nation we aspire to be
right, is
a nation where the Constitution matters. You know, the nation that we aspire to be is one where somebody who tries to overthrow our government does not get to serve in government ever again. That is who we hope to be. I think it is right that our public schools try to inculcate those values in us, because the way that you get Supreme Court justices who will actually share those values is by having this massive civic effort to teach us all that the Constitution matters and that we should enforce it. But when the chips are down, the Constitution is only as good as the worst five people who sit on the Supreme Court.
Right.
If those people did not internalize the lesson that you and I learned in the ninth grade, there's nothing we can do about it.
Well, and I'll just bring you back. You've said it before when I spoke to you last time. You said it doesn't surprise you that this institution that's always been controlled by elites has not been a particularly beneficent organization in American history. That's before Clarence Thomas. That's before the guy who likes beer. This is the history of this Supreme Court. And so while we can and should be outraged and worried and more, what we can't be is surprised that the Supreme Court is not swooping in now to save us from Donald Trump and whatever, heaven help us, a second Trump presidency might usher in. So let me just ask you again, finally, what is to be done? Because giving up is not an option.
I think a lot about a line from President Obama's first inaugural address, where he said, "We must choose our better history." The United States has always had two histories. We have always aspired to be a nation where we have political equality, where we can follow the rules of the road, where we have a constitution. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Those are the words that we created our nation. That has always been one of our histories. And the other history is that we enslaved people. The other history is Jim Crow. The other history is Jim Crow-like treatment of Asian Americans, you know, out on the West Coast. The other history is Korematsu. The other history is Clarence Thomas flying around on all these billionaires' jets. And that has always been our history, too. We have always faced a choice between we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and the other thing. And sometimes we have elections where that choice isn't as readily apparent. This is an election where that choice is immediately apparent.
All right, then. We've been speaking with reporter and author Ian Millhiser. You can find his work on the Supreme Court and other issues on Vox.com. Ian Millhiser, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
The winter 2024 issue of Yes Magazine focuses on elder issues, which turns out to mean every issue, really. There are profiles of older people living lives full of purpose, in counter to a societal and media narrative about the superfluousness of those outside of sponsor desirable demographics. But questions of health care, of self-reliance and political power, of media visibility and the intersectionality of concerns, those are questions for all of us who hope to live in a caring, humane society. Considering them through the prism of age can bring them into a sharp focus. A longtime activist and founder of May 1st Movement Technology, Alfredo Lopez is a founder and advisor with the group Radical Elders. He joins us now by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome back to Counterspin, Alfredo Lopez.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for it's always great to speak with you, and I appreciate the conversation.
Well, thank you. You've been organizing and writing and teaching for economic and racial justice for a long time. I think we maybe first had you on the show in 1996, talking about censorship of labor advertising. What led you and others to create Radical Elders? What was the particular need you saw or space that needed filling?
Well, a couple of things. First and foremost, to be honest, I got old, so I became an elder, and I was a radical elder. I've been in our movement about 58 years is the amount of time that I've spent in the left of this country, very wonderful years, but starting to get old. I'm now in my 70s, and I was looking around for something that focused on the very specific issues that and the particularity of the issues that I faced as a human being in my 70s, and that many people who I knew in my age bracket were facing. And I found nothing. I found a bunch of liberal organizations that sought to reform this and that, expand this and that, or reestablish particular programs that have been dismantled, et cetera. But nobody really framed the issue from the political perspective that has actually framed my life. And a bunch of people were feeling that way that I knew. And so we got together and we started discussing the possibility, what about creating a left-wing elders organization? Is that conceivable? Is it feasible? And what is the potential of doing that? And part of the potential is that people over the age of 55 represent nearly 30% of the population of this country, a humongous chunk of the U.S. population. And for the most part, they are people who are targeted by the increasingly oppressive and restrictive human treatment that emanates from the crisis of the society. But also, they tend to be rightward drifting as a population, as a huge population. And we as left-wing people should be doing something about that. I mean, we should be thinking in terms of that community, because as we looked around, not only weren't there organizations, but our entire family within the left-wing movement of this country, which does wonderful work in a bunch of areas, had no specific program for elder people. And so we launched the organization with that intent of actually publicizing the issue, organizing elders, but also, very frankly, moving the left to a greater level of consciousness about what the major struggles and issues are within the elder community, elder population, and what the potential of that population is politically. That was what we thought. And we started about 3 years ago. We officially launched the organization 2 years ago, and we've been functioning for the last 2 years.
Well, thank you. You and I know corporate advertiser-driven news media are very happy with a divide-and-conquer vision that extends to generations. So we see news media constantly pitting young people versus older people, as though Social Security, for example, is just straight-up draining wealth from young people to funnel it to greedy seniors. Media narratives are part of the fight here, yeah?
Yes, absolutely. More than at any other moment, in my opinion, in my life anyway, and perhaps in the entirety of history, our media molds consciousness in ways that drive people and guide people and affect the outcomes of human interaction. It's more than ever, ever, ever before. And that is, to a large extent, media's role. So, yeah, you do have it. And I bristle in ways that I hadn't before, because now in this organization, leading, you know, in the leadership of this organization, I'm so much more conscious of this stuff. Commercials that make fun of older people, making fun of elders. In fact, we have such an anti-elder consciousness that for the first time in my life, the major issue in the presidential election is who's older.
Right.
I mean, is this guy too old? Now, I'm not saying that Joe Biden, I'm not even going to talk about Donald Trump. Donald Trump should be disqualified for every reason on earth, obviously, starting with the fact that he's a fascist leader. But Joe Biden, it's possible that he is past his prime and does not have the faculties or facilities, the capabilities to lead. But look at the way they frame the conversation. Is he too old? What does that mean, is he too old? Everything that we do and say about elders is, in fact, a distortion of reality. Now, I'm not arguing that Joe Biden should be president of the United States. As far as I'm concerned, we should restructure everything. There shouldn't be a president of the United States. But, you know, and I think that he's demonstrated some of his problems most recently with the wholesale massacre of people in Gaza.
Yeah.
But the framing of it as an age issue is an indication of how this propaganda has worked. And it works all the time. And you're right about Social Security is a very, very important issue. Social Security, first of all, Social Security has never actually done what it was supposed to do. The purpose of Social Security was supposed to be after you get finished working, you retire, you have a sustainable wage. That's never been a sustainable wage.
Right.
And right now, Social Security is a joke because effectively, when you measure it against the standard of living or the cost of living, rather, in the last 20 years, we've lost a third of the Social Security, literally. It has gone down by a third given the cost of living and other cuts that you see. I'll give you an example of the myth of Social Security. People say in relationship to Medicare, in relationship to the medical insurance, that medical insurance is free for Social Security recipients.
Yeah.
Nothing could be further from the truth. First of all, they take a portion of your Social Security payment to pay for the program. Second of all, if you want real health insurance, including hospitalization, all the stuff you're going to need as you get older, you have to have a special program for that. I personally pay nearly $400 a month for my so-called free insurance.
Right.
There are people who pay much, much more. So, yeah, all of this is mythological. Our position on Social Security is Social Security shouldn't exist. What should exist is a sustainable wage, a living capability for all people, elders, over the age of whatever we choose. If it's 65, so be it. But all these people should have sustainable life, and there should be a sustainable life program. That's what makes us radical. We're not like the Association of Retired People. We're not like all these other elder associations that call for reforms of this and that. Essentially, our reform starts at the impact of these programs and not their nuts and bolts. The impact of any social welfare, social security system, social insurance system should be the sustainability of people's lives. People should have a sustainable life, should be able to afford what they need, and they should have full medical health insurance, full wellness care, everything involved in the prolonging of life. We should, as a population, never be jettisoned. And that's what U.S. capitalism does right now. It jettisons its elders.
Well, I want to give you an opportunity to make clear what is clear to me, which is that radical elders is not a backward-looking group. Being a radical elder means being interested and invested in the future.
That's correct. We ain't done yet. It's our slogan. I just want to say we've worked very hard for this. We are also an intentional organization.
Mm-hmm.
And for an organization in our demographic, our members are all over the age of 55. Many of them are 60s, 70s, and 80s. So these are people who were around, many of whom were around the 1970s, 1960s. And we are intentional. That means that we work very hard to make sure that a high percentage, and in our case, it's more than half, of the leadership and representational bodies of our organization are people of the global majority, what's called people of color, like myself and like a whole bunch of other people. And also that more than half women. And these are intentionality commitments that while many of the younger revolutionaries say, oh, well, you know, that's great, you know, but we do that automatically. For our generation, as you know, Janine, this is not automatic in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
Our generation is quite used to a bunch of white men screaming at each other in a room and kind of adding us onto the leadership bodies in tokenist gestures.
Yeah.
We commit ourselves to this because we understand, obviously, that these populations, I mean, you're talking about, in the case of Social Security, there are a lot of people who don't get Social Security because they've been in professions and jobs that do not allow for contributions to the Social Security system. Most of those people are people of the global majority, of people of color, and the great majority of them are women. And to talk about Social Security, it's not a topic of conversation because they don't got none.
Right.
And we have members who are in that kind of a situation. So it kind of changes your conversation about all the issues. And so we're getting ready to converse about these things more. We do a lot of online activities as an organization. We are, to a large extent, an online organization because we're old. We can't travel as much, et cetera, et cetera. And that's where the left is going online in a lot of ways. And we're having this huge activity March 16th. We're calling it a day of action. And we're getting ready to put the final touches on it. It's an amazing day with all kinds of stuff happening all day long. And people can tune into that. And to learn more about our organization, what you do is you go to radicalelders.net. Radicalelders.net. That's our website that has all the information you need.
All right, then. Well, we'll end it just for today. We've been speaking with Alfredo Lopez of May First Movement Technology and Radical Elders online at radicalelders.net. Alfredo Lopez, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.